Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review. I'm Ben Ryland. Today we'll take a trip to the cinema with the film critics Anna Smith and Karen Krasanovich. They'll be our guides through what's on the big screen this week. Plus, we're taking the temperature of Amsterdam's arts scene. We'll meet the artist Molly Parkin to find out about her rather colourful life. And in this week's Global Countdown, we're jumping in a German time machine. They make the best time machines. That's all ahead on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Anna and Karen, welcome to the program this week. Thank you both for joining us. Now, our first film today is Una, which is the story of a young woman searching for answers from a man who abused her as a child. This stars Rooney Mara as the titular character and Ben Mendelsohn as Ray, the man in question. First, let's hear a little slice of the film.
You changed your name. Is that difficult?
It's an IP?
Yeah, it's all good, mate.
How long have you been married?
4 years.
Poor woman, no idea who she's married to. I don't know anything about you.
You were my neighbor's daughter, not a target.
Where did you go? Why did you leave me?
Ray, can you hear me?
I was a stupid girl with a stupid crush.
That's a clip from Una, which stars Rooney Mara and Ben Mendelsohn. Lots to say about this film. First, interestingly, it is based on the play called Blackbird by David Harrower, and it's actually directed by a theatre director, Benedict Andrews, as well. Anna, one thing that sticks out at me first is that they changed the name of the film from Blackbird, which is quite an interesting name for a film, to Una, which is rather less interesting.
It is rather, isn't it? I'm not sure their reasoning behind that. And they've also changed quite a lot, as I understand it, from the original play. It's always very, very difficult to do an adaptation of a play for the big screen, and this one, I think, is quite ambitious in trying to open it out. And personally, I thought the strongest elements of it was the two-hander between the two leads, which is the essential essence of the play.
Karen, tell me about your thoughts on this film. Listening to that clip there, we could hear that there were some interesting accents being thrown around, weren't there?
Oh, definitely, mate. I mean, Rooney Mara and Mendelsohn, they sound very, very different. You're wondering, how do these people come together? I mean, when I chose to talk about Una for this show, I was very interested in the fact that we've had a lot of theatrical films of late, or theatrical directors coming to film, and that recently has been quite successful, isn't always. And I think, obviously, when you get different accents, that automatically means to me that there's funding differences or some, you know, money's coming from different areas. But that's not so interesting, I don't think, to people that want to go see it. I think you're going to be interested in, is there chemistry? Does the story hold together? And I think I would say, yes, there is chemistry. Does the story hold together? It does. I'd love to tell you some spoilers. I really would.
I can tell.
But Una is very interesting. There's a lot to talk about. But ultimately, I think this is the first time feature by
Benedict Andrews.
Benedict Andrews. Yes, I was just going to say that.
So he's an Australian theatre director.
Yeah.
He also directed A Streetcar Named Desire for the National Theatre as well.
But there is a pace problem with Una, which I think robs it somewhat of its punch. As Anna was suggesting, that Blackbird, the play, versus Una, I mean, Una's trying to open it up, but Blackbird didn't have the flashbacks that Una has. And in a way, I think there's when you're imagining in a theater what those two are telling each other, because they're telling each other their versions of the story.
And is the reason, perhaps, that they've introduced the flashback mechanism into the story is that maybe that was an attempt to take it away from its theatre and stage origins? Because that can sometimes be a bit of a limitation. Because, look, I remember a lot of analyses of the Hitchcock film, Dial M for Murder. A lot of people that watch that film don't like it because when you watch it, it's pretty much just a play on screen.
Yes.
And that's not favourable to a lot of film critics. Anna, how do you feel about that? If the story works perfectly within just one setting, perhaps, is it fine to just make a film set in one scene and just say, well, yes, this was a play, now it's a movie, but that's okay because it's still a good story?
I think it's a bold move and it doesn't work for all audiences, but personally, I do enjoy watching that kind of film. I think you know what you're getting as an audience member when you sign up to go and see a play adaptation. And if it is two people in a room talking to each other and it's really, really good, then fine, so be it. I think you're right, this one is a little bit ambitious and trying to give it a bit more cinematic scope and perhaps would have been better sticking with the original format.
Karen, this one has actually been compared to Kubrick's adaptation of Lolita, probably just because it covers some fairly similar themes there. But from what I can tell from you, this one doesn't really hit the mark. What was holding it back for you?
Just major pacing problems. Just really, it took too long to get to the point. It was unfolding weeks. You could sort of predict what was going to happen. And actually, I will say this spoiler, I guess. I think the lesson of this film and of the play, I'm assuming I haven't seen the play, is that you do fall in love with inappropriate people. And so in a way, it's a turn. People were saying it's Lolita in reverse. I'm not really quite sure that is quite the same. But it's a woman, initially it's a woman going to reclaim her past and trying to figure out her past. But how she does it also impacts everybody's future.
Rooney Mara has been on an interesting trajectory lately. Of course, it wasn't so long ago that she was in Carol, which was a fantastic film. It achieved praise everywhere. She's still currently on the big screen in A Ghost Story, with an absolutely magnificent performance in that brilliant film as well.
Sorry. I thought you meant the guy under the sheet. Sorry.
She wasn't. That was Casey Affleck. Her performance in that film is absolutely brilliant. Now, what's interesting, though, is that she wouldn't have necessarily known that film was going to achieve a lot of the praise that it got. That was a bit of a sleeper hit, one might say. Her career is at an interesting point right now, isn't it, with this film and then A Ghost Story at the same time. They're both sort of films that they don't really seem like obvious choices. Anna, where do you see Rooney Mara as far as an actress and her career at the moment?
She's always been the sort of upper end of art house, hasn't she? Solid, reliable, but very understated. And I think she's been understated to a fault in a lot of her work. But recently, I feel like she's been taking more characterful roles. And actually, for all its flaws, I think Una is one of her finest performances to date. I think she's really good in it. And I think she's got a lot of chemistry, as Karen says, with Ben Mendelsohn. She's a fascinating character. And the dynamic between those two is really well played. So I think she is coming into her own, yeah.
Well, that is Una, which is out in cinemas here in the UK today. Our next film takes us to the Yorkshire Dales, where we meet a young farmer called Johnny Saxby, whose life is changed when a Romanian worker, Gorga, turns up to help him out on the farm. Now, the film is called God's Own Country and is directed by Francis Lee. Let's hear a little piece.
In my country, spring is the most beautiful.
Just so you're clear, he's here to work.
So I'm on your shoulders now.
What do you want?
I want it to be different.
Anna, it sort of feels as though the sector of cinema one might call queer cinema has certainly found a new place of acceptance recently, perhaps because of the enormous success of Moonlight. But of course, there are many, many, many other films that have come long before that one as well. But it does feel as though they're receiving a lot more prominence at the moment. A few people that I know have mentioned this film to me already. Sadly, I've not managed to see it yet. But the one film that comes up to describe what it is seems to be Brokeback Mountain. Is that a fair comparison?
It's perhaps slightly reductive, but it's a very obvious comparison. And when you watch the film, you'll see why. It's about two men who are out in farming in the wilderness, drawn together despite having a kind of hostility initially. And it's very sensitive, it's very poetic, rugged landscape, quite explicit sex scenes. I thought it was in some ways even better than Brokeback Mountain. It felt a little bit more authentic, very naturalistic performances. There were a lot of brooding silences, very meaningful performances from the two young men. And it comes from a very real place. It's directed by Francis Lee, who grew up himself in that Yorkshire farming community. And it just has that air of authenticity that keeps you watching and just keeps you gripped because you believe every single thing that you're seeing. It doesn't feel like a piece of cinema. You're just totally absorbed.
There's a lot of pressure on films like this at the moment because, of course, it is still a very politically loaded topic, this depiction in a realistic light of homosexuality on the screen. And the pressure seems to be that we need to portray it in a way that is constructive, but also authentic and honest, and somehow presents these characters in an authentic light that gives some good to the world. For all its merits, Brokeback Mountain is criticised for being another chapter in that long history of gay characters on the screen that meet some sort of sad, dismal end. Without giving anything away, do you come away from this feeling as though you've seen something that is constructive to the overall political element?
Yes, I came away feeling quite uplifted and charmed and moved. It's quite broad in parts. It's actually quite mainstream in its tone, I think, and certainly in terms of its conclusion. But I don't think the same kind of criticisms will be levelled at this film that were levelled at Brokeback Mountain.
Karen, I know it is simplistic to make reference to Moonlight simply because both of these films deal with gay issues, but that is generally what happens. That is how marketing teams and distributors will be looking at this and seeing whether there's a gap in the market for this kind of film at the moment. What do you think the overall impact has been? The fact that Moonlight was enormously successful, has that made this sort of film perhaps more attractive to mainstream marketers as far as selling tickets goes?
I think it has broken into gay cinema or even just a dramatic cinema. I mean, I think it'd be really interesting if we saw being gay is not so bad. It's really okay. I'd be creeping around the countryside. I'm secretly heterosexual. You know, it's just kind of, you swap things around, it gets very odd.
Never would have guessed.
But this really does show us a sector of how people live that we hadn't seen before. If we had seen it, it hadn't been done in this way. Also, I think Josh O'Connor is very, very good. I mean, he was in The Riot Club, Florence Foster Jenkins, and The Jurls. But also, it's a pro-European film. It's an anti-Brexit film, which I think is interesting. It's a bit political. And it's also very positive about country, you know, what happens in the country. I spent a lot of time in the country, and they're not people sitting there in their cottage. I mean, they're cottages. Sorry, that was the wrong word. But, gay people do live in the country sometimes, and they do sometimes meet in the country, and they are sometimes happy. So
We're going to be seeing a film coming out fairly soon from Luca Guadagnino, Call Me By Your Name. It's a very, very hotly anticipated film. Lots of expectations for that. I hope it doesn't weigh too much on the film. But there are a lot of people looking forward to that film, and it feels as though we are moving into some sort of period where we're going to see more of these films that aren't taking advantage of the current mood, but actually responding to it and maybe giving us what could be a golden age for greater acceptance in the cinema. Anna, is that a fair prediction?
I hope so. I think things are moving on all the time, aren't they? And every year I think we see more films like this. We've also got Battle of the Sexes coming up about Billie Jean King and her emerging sexuality. And I think that'll be a very interesting film as well. So, yeah, I think times are moving.
Great. That is God's Own Country, which I'm very much looking forward to. And you can catch that out on the big screen today. It will be hitting American screens in October. Now we're going to speed up the pace a little bit as we discuss Stratton, a new action thriller starring Dominic Cooper as a British Special Boat Service commando who's on a mission to track down an international terrorist. We've had a few films that have followed similar storylines this year. Karen, does this one stand out to anyone?
Okay, full disclaimer. I worked on this film.
Uh-oh.
So, but only as research and only as fact-checking. Yes, I did see all those Zodiacs I looked up and all the inside of. Did you even know there was an SBS Boathouse? I did not know this. But, okay. This is directed by Simon West, and it's taken from a book by Duncan Falconer and written by Warren Davis II.
Simon West being the man behind Con Air,
yes.
Tomb Raider,
Expendables 2.
All the classics,
yeah,
Karen.
All the classics. And you think he knows how to handle action pretty well, right? But this is, it's a low-budget British production, and I remember we were camped out in Twickenham and everybody's running off to Rome. It's like, why can't we go to Rome? But never mind. Okay, enough of that. We're going to look at the finished project now. It was originally done for Henry Cavill, and then he dropped out. So, what, we, yeah.
You being an insider, Karen, can you give us any hint on why he might have dropped out?
I don't really, but I think there were script issues, and hopefully I'm not, how long does my Does my NDA extend? I'm not sure.
That must have been an ironclad contract with Batman versus Superman then, if he's sensitive to script issues.
I think it was right around the time of... Anyway, I think there were some issues with the original, the underlying rights, and I think that there were some issues with the story that couldn't be resolved to his satisfaction. Probably couldn't fit into his schedule either. So we're scrambling to get another actor. I've freshly seen this. I just saw this today, in fact. And I really wanted it to be good. I really wanted it to be good.
For listeners, I can see the disappointment.
I'm sorry about that. We have a shootout at the beginning of the film. They're trying to escape in a... Thank you for nodding in. I appreciate that. They're trying to escape in a truck, some type of pickup truck, and they drive into a gravel silo? You're trying to escape. You don't drive into something that's round. I'm sorry. And then he drives along the coastline. That famously ends. Coastlines end, okay? So automatically I'm thinking, oh, man, come on. I wanted this to be really smart. The action does seem really good. You know, at first you get, you know, all that. I thought the research was great. But anyway, I should let Anna give us her opinion.
Anna, tell us about this. Aside from the absolutely flawless researching work done on this film.
Yes, excellent research.
Was there anything else that you walked away with from this film aside from maybe mild puzzlement?
There were a couple of decent action scenes, I agree. There was a bus at one point which was requisitioned, and that was fun. I enjoyed that, and I'm not a big action fan. And there was a couple of houseboat scenes which were all right. Derek Jacobi, very solemn performance. But as a rule, this film is not one I would recommend. It felt like the script had been chopped up, rewritten, thrown out, started all over again. It felt completely conflicted and confused, and characters were inconsistent to the point of unintentional hilarity. I mean, Connie Nielsen is absolutely appalling as a head of MI5, isn't she? And, you know, it's certainly in the screening I went to, people were laughing, and I believe the same thing was happening today. And I don't like that loud, sarcastic laughter thing. I feel that seems a bit snobby, but I couldn't help myself. Mm. It was that bad.
Do British films have to try a little bit harder when you're presenting yourself as just your basic, not really thinking action film that's really just for guzzling a whole bucket of popcorn and switching off your brain? You generally go to the American films, don't you? When a British film seeks to be a film like that, do they need to try a little bit harder?
Well, you need a big budget generally. Yeah. I think that's the problem. And I think that was probably a lot of Stratton's problems, that it didn't have the budget to compete with the big Hollywood boys. And that's what it was trying to do.
But I mean, James Bond is, I mean, that's why I think, you know, who does, and traditionally, who does action better? I mean, the Brits sort of kicked it off. And then
that's part of the problem, though, isn't it? Because James Bond has really created its own genre and no one else can really edge away at it.
And then Bourne has challenged that. And then Austin Powers undermined it. It actually really did. So the fact that they've done this, I think with more money and with Henry Cavill, not that Dominic West isn't good. He bleeds and sweats really well.
Dominic Cooper, sorry.
There's one bit where you don't know if he's sweating or crying, which I quite liked. I thought, oh, I feel so conflicted. But there are bits of it that just, and this is unforgivable, just don't make sense. There's a bit where the bad guy is blurry. We know it's the bad guy, but the protagonist doesn't. Come on, turn your head. You're supposed to be in the spy game. Turn your head.
Oh, Karen, I feel your pain.
Sorry, thank you.
That is Stratton. It seems as though they spend not enough on the special effects, far too much on the research work. It's out in cinemas in the United Kingdom today. And now to round up this quartet of films this week, we turn to Patty Cakes, a drama about an aspiring rapper called Patricia, why not, trying to find success in her downtrodden hometown in New Jersey. Let's hear a little piece.
The queen is in the building. Introducing Miss Patricia Dabrowski, a.k.a. Patty Cakes, a.k.a. Kendall P.
Gorgeous.
Hey, boss bitch.
Where do you see yourself in 5 years?
I hope to still be working for you, sir.
Your pen game is ridiculous.
You have notebooks full of songs, Pete. How badly do you want this?
You don't have the musical bone in your body, and you sure as hell can't sing. What kind of music are we talking about here?
I've been rapping.
Rapping?
Rhyming, I'm singing, you know?
Anna, I was telling you just before we started talking today on the show that when I saw the marketing for this film, I really wasn't sure what to make of it. And of course, the whole idea behind marketing is to try and tell people straight away, this is what this film is going to be. You'll like it because of this. And this film, it looks like an interesting film, I'll tell you that much, but it's not obvious. It's very difficult to look at it and say, I know what this is going to be. Tell me your impressions.
I would say it's a feel-good indie hit about an underdog who wants to make it big. It's sort of writ large, but all the more power to it for that. You come out with a big smile on your face. You know, kind of think Little Miss Sunshine, that sort of Sundance hit vibe. It's about misfits who kind of band together and try to make it work. And it's funny, it's charming, beautifully acted. And again, it's got an authenticity about it because the director grew up in New Jersey and he wrote a lot of the raps himself.
And so the director is also the writer of the film, which is generally quite a good sign, I think. Jeremy Jasper is the director's name. He's got a background in music video direction for such artists as Selena Gomez and Florence and the Machine. So that really lends the whole musical element some credibility on the screen as well.
It definitely does. And what surprised me, I found out having watched it, is the star Danielle McDonald is actually Australian and she'd never rapped before. But she's utterly convincing. She's absolutely brilliant in this. And I really like the fact that she's a bigger girl and there's a little bit about being a plus size girl and the kind of fat shaming she gets and the way she's treated in the local community, but the way she kind of harnesses that and makes it work for her in her own alter ego.
So tell us a little bit more about the music then, because as you suggest, a lot of the music did actually come from the writer and director Jeremy Jasper. How do they sound on the screen? Because I know sometimes when you've got music that's written especially for a film, you kind of listen to it and think, well, you know, that doesn't really sound like the kind of music that could actually be successful in the real world. This doesn't really come across as realistic. How does it come out in this?
Well, I think the best elements of it are the freestyling. There's a flavour of 8 Mile in this. You see her freestyling in these sort of street battles. And you definitely believe then that that's how she would do it. And you're also won over by her talent and her ability and you're rooting for her to kind of slay these guys. In terms of the slightly strange band that is formed towards the end of the film with a kind of grime artist, I don't think it's necessarily meant to be brilliant. It's meant to be a bit rough around the edges. So that kind of works. It's not sort of holding up saying, oh, these guys are great chart successes.
Is there also some interesting interplay? I was surprised to see Kathy Moriarty in this. Remembering her from Raging Bull, and you think, wow, she's, you know, anyway.
She's been artificially aged for this.
Yeah.
She's actually, I saw her in Cannes looking incredibly glamorous promoting this film. But yes, so she plays the grandmother in a wheelchair and it's a very vanity-free performance. Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering about the interplay between Barb and then Bridget Everett and her daughter. And I think that that's actually very challenging and refreshing to see because anybody that's a woman and has a mother, you're going to battle a little.
Yeah, it's a really lovely portrait, although it's initially that there's a lot of facility between mother and daughter. The idea is that Patty obviously wants to be a rapper, but her mother's a drunk. And what's significant is that her mother wanted to be a singer and was a fairly successful singer, but then gave up her dreams to have a child. So there's that kind of dynamic between them is very, very tense. And there's a lot of room for redemption there.
Karen, as someone who works on films yourself, do you think, I mean, is it difficult sometimes to market a film like this one that doesn't really sit perfectly into any particular box? How difficult is it to draw those strings and target the right audience?
Well, I think what Anna said is sort of like Little Miss Sunshine. It's once it leaves a festival, it will sort of have a genre label, whether it's Tangerine or, I mean, obviously Tangerine had a different sort of marketing hashtag, if you will. But this one was nominated for the Sundance Grand Jury and also nominated for the Cannes Golden Camera, I think, as well. So looks amazing. So I think if it's got a good word of mouth, people who get tired of, I don't want to see a horror movie and I don't want to see a romance and I don't want to see an action film and I don't want to see a dreary.
People get tired of just the idea of genre.
Well, just you say European art house, you think, oh, good, I'll just have a little nap. and sometimes it's good and sometimes it's not. And I think that this one promises something. I mean, you know, Gang of Misfits. Yes, we want to see that. A rapping, loving pharmacist. I've never seen one of those before. You know, and it's the promise of something unusual and different. And sometimes that goes terribly wrong. But this looks sparkling. And also the fact that the music's good. Music just means so much. And the editing's good. It's snappy. you know, we all need to be fluffed up and lifted up when we come out of the cinema from time to time.
Indeed, indeed. And some good music, really. Nothing does it better than that. Patty Cakes is out in UK cinemas now and will hit Australia later in the month. Anna Smith and Karen Krasanovich, thank you both for your film reviews today. Now, Anna and Karen will be sticking around in the studio, but first, we're going to meet the artist Molly Parkin. Molly has had a colourful life, and not just as a painter. She is also well known for her sexually charged novels and some hedonistic exploits in the 60s as well. My goodness. She speaks to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who else, to talk about her life stories, which includes a rather sexy moment with Louis Armstrong.
Molly, we're here to talk about your upcoming exhibition, Life in Color, which is, I think, is a perfect name for you. tell us what we'll be able to see there. Is it new paintings, or will it be some sort of retrospective of your work?
Well, there's a mixture, really, because I never stopped painting. When I gave up drink 15 years ago, I haven't had a drop, which for people, well, they're all dead now, the people who continue to drink, as I would have been myself. I went for help and I haven't had. And within a week of giving up drinking from a blockage of 30 years, when I kicked out that first husband, he took my muse with him. And I had to do all other things, you know, like write books. Comic eroticas is what I wrote, you know, for 10 years. So those went all over the world and were translated. But the paintings came back to me when I gave up drink. Within a week, I went on a tour to the South Pole for the Sunday Telegraph colour supplement. And I painted all these things bobbing in the water. And I mean, wonderful paintings. And I had an exhibition when I came back, which sold out, and I've never stopped painting since.
Do you still write comic eroticas? You know, because I know you're very well known.
Well,
for those.
Yes, I was very well known for my comic eroticas because that's the life that I led. You know, I had a cast of thousands of lovers. I only had two husbands, but when I disposed of those two, oh, bless them, I just went in, you know, for saying yes as a matter of course. I was drinking, of course. I was at Ronnie Scott's till 3 a.m, you know what I mean? And lovely things happen when your head's full of jazz and your stomach's full of drink.
And what's your involvement with fashion? Because you worked in the media industry for a while.
I hate the world of fashion. Oh. That was my most miserable time, and that's when my drinking really, really increased. I designed a whole load of clothes because I'm good at that, because that's what we did, aunties and me. None of us had any money, but you had to have something new to wear to chapel. 3 times chapel, Welsh chapel for me, in the morning, in the afternoon and the evening. And so it would be nice to change at least a blouse or something, you know what I mean? So I spent the rest of the week knitting or sewing in front of the fire and me listening to all of their tales, because they were all spinsters, you see, because you know, it was the Second World War and the men were getting killed. So there's nothing as raunchy as virgins, you know, of 60 or 70. The humour is just wonderful. And so I knew how to do organised clothes. And then I went to the East End and got a whole load of clothes made and opened a boutique just off the King's Road, in the same road where my Welsh chapel was, actually, Radnor Walk. And because it was Easter and you weren't allowed to have staff, but the owner could, and every other shop was closed, I opened it myself at 8 o'clock in the morning. And a little lady, she was lady something or other, came, and she had a little funny jumper on and a tweed skirt. She said, "I love these clothes and the colours and everything." I said, "You'd look good in those, darling." She said, "I'm over 80. And I said, "It's a good age to start." I'm over 80, so I knew what I was talking about. She bought a whole lot. She bought a hat, a skirt, trousers, and a jacket and a top. And she waltzed out. She was dancing as she went out. She said, "My family will be outraged." And I said, "Tell them to fuck off, darling." I kept it open till 11 o'clock at night. I was there on my own selling. The queue was all the way up Radnor Walk to the King's Road, because the word had gone around there's a great shop selling really great stuff. And then I sold that, made a lot of money. I sold it to one of the 3 Cockney photographers, Terence Donovan. He bought it from me.
Molly, I have, you know, you have so many interesting stories in your life, but I was reading so many articles. There's a fantastic story of Louis Armstrong. I mean, if you don't mind sharing it with us.
I was taken by a jazz pianist, a Welsh boy, when I first came to London to teach after art school. I was 22 and I was teaching at Elephant and Castle, and he said, "Moll, you must come to Earl's Court at the weekend because Louis Armstrong is there." Well, Louis Armstrong wasn't famous at that time, not in this country. But anyway, we went to, he said, "Once you hear him play jazz, that you're a jazz fan for life, Moll." So I went there. He introduced me to Louis at the end of the concert, and Louis took one look. Well, I didn't look as I do now, but I had no lipstick on, but loads of black around my eyes, a load of black hair, and a purple cotton frock.
Again,
he took
purple.
One look and he said, "You're mine for the night, honey." And he drew me to him. He's strong. And I said, "Oh, hold on." I said, "I have to be at Elephant and Castle teaching the kids art. I can't do that." And so he just, to shut me up, he kissed me on the mouth. When Louis kissed you, he takes in your nose and your chin as well. and the stirring of my blood, I tore myself away and I ran all the way to the tube station. My heart was hammering. And within a week, I went and bought French perfume instead of lavender water. And within a week, I'd met James Robertson Justice, who was a big, big film star at that time, friend of Prince Philip and all of that lot. And so he introduced me to sex and literature and everything. And then a new Molly was born.
Molly Parkin's show Life in Colour opens tomorrow at the 508 Kings Road Gallery, and it will be on until the 28th of September. To Amsterdam now. For 40 years, Outmarkt Festival has marked the beginning of the cultural season in the Netherlands, providing a platform for the country's numerous museums and performance artists to show what they're up to in the months to come. So, what's hot and what's not? Well, Monocle's Amsterdam correspondent Venetia Rainey has been taking the temperature of the arts and culture scene.
Music drifting in the air, laughter coming out of marquees, and lots of people having beers by the water. This is Outmarkt, an annual end-of-summer gathering of the Dutch arts and culture world. Surveying the scene with a smile is Arthur van Schendel, one of the founders of this event back in 1977. He says their aim at the time was simple.
Well, the idea behind this is that the artists make interesting art, and you always have the problem, how do you get an audience? And then we decided, let's put on a small festival outside, and we had 25 market stalls and two stages, and try to tell people what goes on in the city.
For Arthur, despite the deluge of information now available to people online, the problem facing the arts and culture world is still the same: finding that audience. That's why he believes Outmarkt's roster of short, free events is just as important as ever for connecting artists with viewers.
It's a bridge, it's not a festival. It's not a festival where you buy a ticket and you go and you see who perform. No, it is the bridge between the arts and the public and the arts and the city.
Such opportunities are especially important for new acts, like experimental performance group Teddy's Last Ride from the northern city of Groningen. Thrilling fusion of dance, theatre and music, their acclaimed show is based on the underground rave scene in London during the 80s and 90s and drew a big and varied crowd Outmarkt. One of the performers, Andy Smart, says the festival helps break down the usual barriers and exposes people to new things in the arts world.
You know, it's sort of everything's on pins and needles, and this kind of exchange really fires a synapsis, and you never know where that kind of energy goes or who's watching or who's taking notes and who's involved. So yeah, absolutely. It sort of seems to make everything a little bit more fluid.
This year, things at Outmarkt are especially fluid. The festival has been relocated to the city's former maritime complex on the water, and one of the most popular items on the programme is De Dolfijn, a local synchronised swimming team whose show is somewhere between ballet and water acrobatics.
Y'all ready for this?
Dressed in a brightly coloured swimsuit and matching headpiece covered in sequins, Linda Hanko explains why her team were keen to participate in the festival.
I think this is a very good way to
change the stigma around synchronized swimming, because usually they say it's a girl sport and it's not difficult at all. But when people see it and they see how difficult it is, that changes the perception of it. So I think this is a really good way to make it more popular among the people.
Totally agree.
It's also a great platform for more traditional cultural institutions to attract new visitors. At the Van Gogh Museum podium, people queue for a chance to get a 3D photo taken with a lifelike reconstruction of an almond blossom tree, exactly like the one painted by the Dutch artist. The installation is a way to raise awareness of an exhibition on Van Gogh in Japan that will go up next March. Caroline Vos from the museum's marketing department explains why they, like all Dutch museums, maintain a presence at Oudmarkt despite the internet.
Well, it's really the start of the cultural season in Holland, and it's the best place to introduce the program to a very big audience. I mean, I think there are like 500,000 people each year, so that's a lot. So it's very important to be here.
Because the Van Gogh Museum is incredibly well known. Is it still necessary to do these sorts of things for you guys?
Indeed, we have a lot of visitors, like over 2 million each year. Of course, a lot of them are international, so tourists. We also have a lot of Dutch visitors, but we think the Dutch visitors are still very important, so we want to show them as well that that we are there for them. And a place like Uitmarkt is the perfect place to do something like that.
As the festival draws to an end and the sun begins to set behind the medley of boats and buildings that characterise Amsterdam's skyline in this part of town, there's still time to catch one last act. La Garçon is one of Amsterdam's best-kept secrets, a fun-filled band that are big on wacky outfits and R&B-influenced music. For singer Bart Reinink, the state of the arts and culture scene in the Netherlands at the moment is a mixed bag.
It used to be better. The government now is doing, or have done, a big thing in the theater, in the subsidies. They cut them a lot of them. Festivals are really, really being promoted. So there are, like, in Holland, I think this summer there were like 200 festivals or something in 2 months. That's like crazy.
He says he's not bothered by the city's recent restrictions on noise levels of outdoor gigs, which some have criticized as over the top.
The loudness doesn't make the music, it's how you mix the loudness, and then it's hearable. If it's hearable and danceable, it's good, and 85 decibels, yeah, it's okay. I don't mind. I'm not judging that, no.
So for you, the city of Amsterdam is still a great place to be an artist?
Awesome. Really, really, really awesome, yeah. There are a couple of cities in Netherlands where you can be as an artist, and Amsterdam is the best, in my opinion.
For Monocle in Amsterdam, I'm Venetia Rainey.
Thank you, Venetia. Now to end the show, as always, it's time for a global countdown, and this week we're going to Germany, where we're going back in time, actually quite a while. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, we're going back to 1977. Tell me why we're going back there first.
Well, because the German charts are celebrating 40 years.
40 years.
Yes, and you know, I was reading an article about that. It's the fourth largest music market in the world. And I thought,
fourth largest in the entire world.
Yes, I think it's just behind the US, UK and Japan.
Wow.
So, you know, I think they deserve a little celebration on the Arts Review, don't you think?
I think they definitely deserve their own little section. Fernando, it's an interesting list. First of all, though, tell me, when you were going through this, how do you think it compares to now, the kinds of tracks that you found in the top five?
Well, there are two trends, you know. It's going to be special. So we're going to have the top five from 1977 and the current top five as well. There's two things that stick in mind. I think Germans do like electronic music. For example, you just saw electronic music in American charts like much, much later. And they love a touch of Latiness to their songs. So you see like Spanish artists or even Latin American artists doing very well in the German charts since the 70s.
That's interesting. So it really is, in many ways, mirror image of what we see on some of the charts around the world today. Fernando, maybe we should have a quick look at the top five, though, from 1977. Start us off.
And I have to say, this is the best one, you know, because I love the disco era. So there's a lot of good classics there in the top five. I'll go very briefly. Number five, we have actually the only rock and roll track. It's actually glam rock from the UK. I actually never heard this band before today. It's Moki with It's Your Life. And I think they're from Yorkshire, and they were quite popular at the time as well.
Clearly very popular, especially for the Germans.
Yes. Number four, we have the duo, one of my favorite Spanish duos of all time. It's Baccarat with Sorry I'm a Lady. I mean, they are fantastic. They are extremely popular in Germany. In fact, I believe they're still going on. They're still releasing a couple of singles there. And they do like the easiest and simplest choreographies ever. Because these days you have all this kind of crazy acrobatic dancing. They just like move very slowly their shoulders, and I like that.
I love a good dance you can learn in an afternoon and
Me
take
too.
It out with you that night.
It's easy, you know. It's, and I love how they have their very strong Spanish accent as well. It's a bit kitsch, and the better for it.
All right, so we've got number three now.
Number three was Donna Summer, I Feel Love. I mean, that's a fantastic, iconic song.
An eternal classic.
Eternal classic, written by Giorgio Moroder. You know, you can see the early stages of electronic music in that song as well. Extremely influential.
I don't think there's been a year that's gone by since then that a song has not come out heavily influenced by that one.
Absolutely. Number two, Baccarat again.
I didn't even notice this. Baccarat are in there twice.
Yes.
But that's just greedy, isn't it?
But this time with their biggest hit ever, Yes Sir, I Can Boogie, which is still being used in TV ads everywhere. And again, simple choreography.
Yes. You just reminded me of that track. Of course I know that one.
Yes.
I know that one too, which is weird.
Brilliant. Yeah, I think I went to a wedding in Italy last year that actually played that.
I can imagine that.
They do weddings so much better in Italy. All right, so now we've moved along to, this is number one, isn't it?
I think we have a clip of it. They're from France. Let's hear it.
Seriously, Fernando, I think you could release that today, couldn't you?
It's magical.
It doesn't sound like it's aged.
What did you think of it, Karen?
It sounds like it's straight out of American Gigolo soundtrack. That's all I could think of. Like, that was Moroder, wasn't it?
Yes. And, yeah. You know, it was all kind of the same group of producers, and they're from France, actually. Their name is Space, and they were one of the first ones to do space disco. There was like 4 years between 77 and 81 where space disco was a big trend.
So space disco is its own subgenre of the disco.
Absolutely.
Genre.
I mean, you can't imagine yourself in space listening to this. It's Magic Fly. I like it. What did you think of it, Anna?
Yeah, maybe want to go to a space disco.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Bring it on, space disco. Please.
Maybe next time you'll have to come back to give us your top five countdown from somewhere in space, Fernando.
But I love that.
Before we do that, let's move along to this week's top five. Let's compare it to what we've just found out from 1977. Let's start at number five, though, Fernando.
Yeah, number five, we have the new Justin Bieber track with American producer Blood Pop. The song's called Friends. I mean, it's difficult to now do the 2017 because the tracks from 77 were so amazing. But anyway, Friends is a good song, good bass. Good bass. That's all I can say about that song.
Good bass is important. At number four, we have Imagine Dragons.
Imagine Dragons, the only rock band that is at the charts at the moment with a track called Thunder. They're from Las Vegas. And, you know, it's a nice track, even though I'm not the biggest fan of Imagine Dragons. Number three, again, showing the German love affair with Latinas or anything Latin, is the Colombian singer J Balvin with French DJ Willie William. The track's called Mi Gente, which is the new Despacito, basically. It's climbing very quickly the charts. There's half a billion of streams on YouTube. Very well, doing very well.
The next track is the current Despacito.
Yes, it's still there. And I have exclusive news for you. Despacito is also, I believe this week was on the 16th week at the top of the American charts. They're now tied with Mariah Carey and Boyz II Men, One Sweet Day, as the biggest hit ever. So if they stay another week at number one, they will be the biggest hit single ever in the US. But maybe the new Taylor Swift track might beat that. So it's very exciting times.
Wow, I'm more surprised that Mariah Carey and Boys to Men is the biggest hit ever.
There was a lot of articles about that, apparently because there was not many good new music being released at the time. So it's not that it was actually an amazing song. It was just a bit like, okay, no one's releasing anything.
Okay, and then, so moving along from that, we have the number one track for this week.
Yeah, EXO and Grosso with More Than You Know. Shall we hear a little clip?
Please. That's the number one track, Fernando.
Yeah, it's not space disco, is it? But it's okay. They're from Sweden. They're massive, you know. They do very well across Europe. And I think they're very well paid as well because they play in the best clubs in the world, I would say. So it's a nice track. Again, no space disco, but a good electro house track.
Fernando, I share your concerns completely because we have gone through an exceptional top five list from 1977. And there are some nice tracks in today's top five. But, well, Anna, which one did you prefer?
Oh, well, the 70s, of course, naturally, no contest.
Karen, I expect you're going to be a fairly similar verdict.
I mean, I do like both of them because they do sound so different and they do remind me of times, you know, when things seemed really fresh. And now I'm just wondering, you know, when you hear something new in the charts now, you just think, oh, somebody's obviously been listening to the old stuff because this sounds interesting.
Yeah, it's a shame how having such solid knowledge, a solid cultural knowledge the way that we do, really, it dooms us, doesn't
it?
We just can't
cynical.
Enjoy it.
Yeah,
nothing's new anymore.
Hourly cynical.
Well, that brings us to the end of today's program. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you for your musical journey as always. And Anna and Karen, thank you both for joining us here today. This show was produced by Holly Fisher and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, of course. My name is Ben Rylan, and to play us out, let's please have some more of that 1977 number one. This is Space with Magic Fly. Thanks for listening.